Welcome to Conceptually Speaking, the show where we interview experts in a variety of fields to uncover the systems and patterns that help us to conceptualize and reconceptualize our world. I'm Julie Stern, founder of Education to Save the World and co-author of Learning That Transfers, Designing Curriculum for a Changing World.
And I'm Trevor Elio, English Language Arts Specialist at Ed to Save the World and co-author of Learning That Transfers. This podcast uses our mental model as a sense-making tool through acquiring, connecting, and transferring conceptual relationships to unlock new situations. Our guests identify 3 to 5 concepts at the heart of their field, and we discuss how those concepts play out in a variety of settings. We hope this podcast will inspire teachers and students to design creative solutions to complex problems and accelerate innovation in today's schools. You can find out more about our work at edtosavetheworld.com. This week on Conceptually Speaking, Kayla and I chatted with podcaster, blogger, and creative aficionado, Betsy Patash. One of the many things I love about Betsy's work is its accessibility. Introducing new, more creative and dynamic frames for curriculum and instruction can be a challenge for many educators. But Betsy does an incredible job creating and curating resources that are approachable and scaffolded for educators and students alike. One of my favorite parts about this episode was the amount of time we spent discussing modern forms of composition. Positioning things like podcasting, blogging, and video essays as viable and authentic modes of communication. Considering her massive email lists and following on social media, Betsy knows full well the power of digital media.
Yeah, well, it kind of goes back to what I was talking about before with how visual the modern generation is. And I think because they have grown up with Snapchat, with Instagram stories, with Twitter, they're used to communicating like that. That seems normal to them, you know, creating a book snap about a book that they really like, where they snap a photo of it and tell a little bit of the plot and give it a hashtag and, you know, add little icons and whatever. Like, that's a fun little reading check-in for them that feels very familiar. Tweeting for a character, creating a blog from the perspective of a main character, or searching out social issues in a text that they're reading and then creating like a proposal for a social media campaign around, you know, a key concept from a novel. This is all normal. It's normal for them. It's part of their generation. And so I think building that into curriculum only helps us connect with students more. And again, it's just so relevant. It's not just like an arts and crafts project in English class where we're like, you know, coloring an Instagram post worksheet. It's like, this is how kids create meaning in the world. And I don't think that's going to change when they graduate from high school.
Betsy is a delightful guest with much to say about creativity and communication in the modern classroom. We hope you enjoy the episode. Our guest this week is creative education blogger and podcaster, Betsy Patash. Welcome, Betsy. We're excited to chat with you.
Thanks so much. I'm excited to be here.
So can you talk to us about your work bringing creative curriculum and instruction to educators and students?
Yeah, of course. Well, it's work that lights me up. I absolutely love what I do. When I was a teacher in the classroom, I enjoyed bringing creative practice into my everyday, and I knew that my students enjoyed it too, but I did not find that I had a lot of support in that. I did not always find it easy to explain what I was doing to the folks around me, and I didn't always feel like they were as excited about it as I was. And so when I started to develop the work that I do now, I really wanted to reach out to creative teachers all over the world and help them to feel that level of support, to feel like what they were doing mattered and that there were wonderful reasons to bring creativity into the classroom. And also that somebody had their back and that somebody was going to be doing the research and making the strategies easier to put in place, because a lot of times that type of BD isn't coming from the higher ups at their school. And not only is it not coming, but sometimes it's sort of actively looked down upon, I think, just because of misunderstanding. And I'm not saying it's that way in every school, but I certainly had some challenges and some fights to create the teaching identity that I wanted to create. And I wanted to give teachers a community where they could talk about what they were doing and feel just sort of feel the creative light around them.
Could you talk a little bit about a moment, maybe not the moment, but a moment where you realized that you were not alone in this desire to be doing creative works? I know that I have certainly had moments where I felt like I was the weird loner trying to do things or attempt things in class, but you know, with the advent of the internet and email lists and Facebook groups, I'm in your Facebook group, it's fantastic and massive, and there are all sorts of resources being shared. With the realization of those things, it's really opened up a lot of possibilities for more organic communities of practice to form. So just kind of positioning us at the beginning of your journey, when did you realize that you weren't alone in that desire?
Yeah, well, let's see, it was probably about 7 years ago now, I started my Facebook group, Creative High School English, and you have to have two people to start a Facebook group. So I had myself, and then I made up a fake Facebook identity with my middle name. So it was just me and my fake middle name person.
A very creative beginning.
Yeah. And I would make a post and then I would sign in as the other person and I would heart my post and respond to it. And then I just started to share the group out in different places. If I would make a guest post or if I would make a podcast recording, I would talk about it and I would invite people to come and join. And at first, you know, there were three and then there were five. And now there are, I think, about 17,000. And it's just one of my favorite little corners of the internet. It's such a beautiful place to share ideas and create collaborations. I love to see how teachers share their curriculum and set up connections between like a classroom in the Czech Republic and a classroom in Pennsylvania. Just so many wonderful forms of collaboration happen in there.
That's awesome. And so as I was going through and looking at your blog and reading through and going through all of your resources, what really resonated with me was on the About page, and it got me extra excited about the podcast and chatting with you, was this: you don't feel like lecturing or teaching straight to the test. You want to be creative. I was like, yes, that was me. That was, I had that thought. I had those conversations. And what you mentioned about making strategy seem simple and easy to implement is one of the amazing things that I've noticed with your work and how accessible the materials are and the resources. And one of my favorites that we've even put in our book, I shout it from the rooftops anytime I can, is hexagonal thinking. And we use it in all different content areas and contexts, professional learning, reflective activity. But do you mind sharing a bit with listeners if they haven't heard of what hexagonal or hexagonal thinking is and the beauty of it, the power of it, and how you kind of, where you found the idea or came up with the idea?
Yeah, sure. Well, it was interesting. I think the first time I caught sight of it was in a post on Creative High School English. Somebody had used it. And I saw it again a few months later, somebody had used it and I started digging into it and I got a lot of background. It originally comes from the business world. And as people were building ideas for a business, they would put different concepts on these cards and then start to move the cards around. So each hexagon card has six sides and you can put any word or phrase or even a picture on there. And when you start trying to decide how you're going to lay all the cards together, then you have to start debating with yourself or with whoever you're with, you know, why are you putting that card there? Why are you matching it to that term or idea? I want to put this card there, you know, and, and I think this card should go at the intersection of these two concepts and this picture fits better over here. And as you start to talk about the connections between your cards, you're having these really interesting critical thinking debates about how ideas correlate to each other and how they contrast with each other and sort of the layers of what thing best goes in that one focal intersection point. And it's really fascinating. And like so many concepts in the teaching world, this can all seem vague and, you know, random. And how does this relate to my classroom? Really, I don't want to cut 500 hexagons out. And so my goal was to sort of take what I was learning from all corners of the internet and make it really accessible and easy to put into practice in the classroom. And It is. It's extremely doable. And so I've really enjoyed creating templates and helping teachers with categories that they can put on the cards for the students and showing them that, you know, they can make the decks, or the students can make the decks. They can cut them out, or the students can cut them out, or you can do it digitally. Mm-hmm. And I just get positive story after positive story. And I tell you, it really makes my day every time, because I see these photos from, you know, Argentina and just all over the place where people are like, this works great. I love this. And I'm like, yes, yes, that's the dream. And I really have yet to have anybody say, I threw this out to my students and it was a total dud. It seems to light students up just the way that it lights us up when we start talking about it as educators who love practice.
No, you're absolutely right. We've used it, like I said, in a ton of professional learning settings, and then introduced it to different classrooms that we've worked with. And there has yet to be someone say, oh, my kids wouldn't engage, or my students wouldn't have that conversation. It's the tactile nature, getting to move things around, but also that debate aspect of, oh no, like, I don't think those are here. Or one of my favorite things was to, if I took a hexagon and said, well, what if I move this here? How does that change your thought, or does it work? And having students defend that. So it's beautiful. And I really just, I'm appreciative. Thank you for making it out there and sharing all those templates, because have we not heard about it? And actually, I guess we heard about it on the Cult of Pedagogy podcast. And that's where I started digging in, like, oh yes, this is magic. But it was one of those like golden nuggets that we found. And so with that, and thinking about the not wanting to teach the test, wanting to have these strategies that really engage students and to teach more creatively, what does that mean to you? And I see where you really want teachers to, as you say, teach as their true self. So what does that mean to teach as your true self, or to really be creative in your instructional design?
Well, I mean, for me, every classroom is going to be completely different, because the teacher has a completely different background and interests, and they're going to teach as their best self if they teach, you know, based on what they're passionate about and what they're good at, as well as taking into account a lot what their students care about and what their students are good at and what their students' weaknesses are. And so I feel like when we try to create any kind of cookie cutter approach to what the classroom should look like, mm-hmm. you know, it's just going to fail from the outset. And so I remember reading Parker Palmer as a very young teacher and sort of highlighting every single section about, you know, if you're teaching from the core of yourself, if you're teaching what really matters to you and based out of your own experiences, you're going to be so much more powerful as a teacher. You're going to connect with your students so much more. And I really believe that. And on my first day teaching, I always tell this story. I almost quit teaching after my first day. It was such a disaster for me. I didn't know what to do on the first day. And all my colleague friends were like, oh, you just go over the syllabus. And so I had made this long, dry syllabus according to whatever template I was given. And I passed it out to my teenage classes in period after period and read it out loud. And they were all, you could just see the glaze like fall over their eyes, and you could see them looking at the clock after like 2 minutes. And I it was the first time I ever realized you could be talking and thinking something completely different. So I was like talking and thinking, this is the worst teaching ever. Like, I am an absolute failure. And meanwhile, I'm like reading the required materials. And at the end of the day, I honestly just like laid on the floor of my office and cried for like 2 hours. And I was like, I am never going to lecture again. I'm never going to be standing at the front of the classroom talking at these kids. It doesn't work for me. It doesn't work for them. And for the rest of that first year, it was like poetry slam, performance project, Harkness for a month experiment, literature circles. Like, we never did anything like that again. I was always on the hunt for, how can I put the students at the center? How can I come up with some kind of an interesting final showcase project that we can be focused on throughout the unit that is not about me?
That's awesome. I feel like we've had parallel experiences. I remember with my seventh grade math students thinking, if I'm bored by the end of the day, what are they feeling? And so, and that's what led to my looking for just other ways to teach and to get them to love and appreciate math. And so that's kind of where, how I've ended up where I am, but it's nice to know that it happens to the others.
Absolutely. So bringing together the hexagonal thinking and the painful lecture that it sounds like you have sought to not repeat throughout the rest of your career, I did notice that one of your concepts that you're going to be sharing about today is visual and verbal intersection. So the intersection of those two concepts. So like the importance of talk is still there. Maybe who is doing the talking and what is happening around the classroom is quite different. But could you talk a little bit about the difference between maybe delivering lectures for, you know, elongated periods of time and having students engage, or even you as an educator engage in the intersection of visual and verbal communication?
Yeah, well, I want to give credit to people who can do really interesting lectures. They are out there. I had one college professor, Professor Andreessen, who I could listen to for 100 hours in a row. She was just incredible, but that's not me. And I think in general, in our culture now, when it comes to communication, most things are delivered through a double medium. When I think of how I get my information, how I learn things, how I process things, how things are advertised to me, messaging in the world today tends to be through visuals combined with words. And I think our classrooms are sort of slowly catching up with that. And I find it really interesting. When I think about a project for students and think about how they can make an argument or share what they've learned in a project, I want it to be at that intersection point between things that they can see and design and things that they can know and share through writing or speaking. And I think that they're a very visual generation, the generation that's coming up, and I think that they respond to that. And so when I design, you know, we're going to do Genius Hour, or we're going to do podcasting, or we're going to do blog design around some kind of written argument or whatever it is, like, I'm trying to think, how can I present this to them through a combination of my words and then also visual ideas and sort of matching visual imagery? And also then how can they create through both those mediums? And it's just wonderful. I love doing it that way.
I love that. And that ties into some of the things that we talk about in our book, which is this idea of disciplinary literacy, which is the fact that our goal is not just to fill students' head with content knowledge or equip them with discrete skills, but to begin thinking like someone with disciplinary expertise and understanding. And I think that that goes hand in hand with the way that people are producing and sharing knowledge these days. I mean, look at the number of academics and, you know, literary scholars, or even more widely, like cultural critics who are on podcasts, who are doing video lectures, who are, you know, designing blogs. So I think that it's really interesting to consider, you know, students are still reading texts in English language arts. They're still analyzing media. They're still listening to speeches, but the way that they're producing knowledge is becoming much more authentic to the way that people share and communicate today. So could you talk a little bit about maybe that marriage of old and new, of looking at, you know, students might still be reading. I know that, and I had a curriculum that I had to follow in my district and had texts that I had to read, my students had to read, but what they did with that, you know, it's instead of being passive and receptive, it became generative. It became opportunities for them to produce. So could you talk about that, maybe the tension between those things that maybe isn't quite as there as people might think?
Yeah. I think it's really interesting how sort of a set curriculum or a certain set of standards can feel really constricting, or can feel like a jumping off point. And it's not always easy to make that shift, especially if you've really been piled with a lot of standards and texts you don't like. And I'm sorry if that's happening to our listeners. But I would say, like, for example, I have been really interested in designing podcasting curriculum this year. And many of my teachers that I work with have introduced small or large podcasting units. And so say you want to teach students something traditional, like a research unit, and you want them to create some sort of final product. So you can go through all the steps of the research process. You can teach them how to take all their notes from their research sources and do their bibliography and wrap it all up into a neat package. But instead of doing a research paper, maybe you do a research podcast and you play some interesting models for them of the many, many informative podcasts that are out there in the world, things that will hook them. And then you have them create a show. And as they create their show, you know, they get to bring in these multiple mediums. What music is going to accent their research in an interesting way for the trailer? What is their cover going to look like if they were on Apple Podcasts? You know, they can go into a program, a free program like Canva, and design their podcast cover and make it really interesting and think about what would hook people visually that ties into their research. They can think about, you know, who would they interview? You could tie in some email query skills in your unit and have them actually reach out to an expert in the field and think like maybe your first episode is going to be sharing your research and your second episode is going to be an interview, and make a little series. And then once they've designed and created their podcast and shared it within the class, you can have them submit it. You can have them submit it to Apple Podcasts if you want to go through those steps, or you can put it on a platform like Anchor. And I think when students have the sense that what they're doing relates to the world and is going out into the world and that somebody else might actually listen to it and that they're actually doing everything that a professional podcaster who makes money, you know, as a career would be doing, it is so much more interesting to them than just creating, you know, another 5-page stapled document that they're going to hand in and then get back and then throw away.
So I think that blends nicely into another concept that you shared and wanted to discuss, which is 21st century composition. So I think that thinking about what are the podcasting being one, what are some of the other modes of composition that you are finding your students are really, or students that you work with are really buying into or really fascinated by, maybe that you're currently exploring? Because I do think that that is such an important part of considering, you know, what is the discipline of English language arts and what other means of communication are there besides print, especially in, as you said, our incredibly visual culture. So could you just kind of talk a little bit about what does 21st century composition look like? What does that mean to you? And, you know, what are some of the interesting jumping off points that you're exploring?
Yeah, well, I think it's particularly fascinating for me as a former English teacher who now works with English teachers, but who works with them through all of these 21st century modes of composition, right? Like I, on a daily basis, I'm like writing Instagram captions and designing blog posts and creating pins for Pinterest and recording my podcast and creating videos, like all of these multimodal forms that I think it's interesting for students to explore. That is actually how I communicate and how I have built all of my work and my business. And so for me, it just feels extremely immediate and extremely relevant. And so, for example, I designed a very comprehensive Genius Hour curriculum in the spring. And just in case anybody isn't familiar with Genius Hour, it stems from Google. I think originally they gave employees 20% of their time to work on passion projects. And so that idea extends into the classroom as just a maybe one day a week or 1 week a term or something like that, where teachers give students a chance to explore passion. And it functions really well in the ELA classroom because you can use various modes of expression to document that passion project. And so as I was creating the curriculum, I designed 3 avenues for documentation, and it was going to be an Instagram feed or a video channel or a blog. And on any of those mediums, a student can write beautifully about what they're doing. And interestingly, they can create powerful imagery that complements what they're doing. It can be photography, it can be infographics, it can be regular graphics. They can create video clips. They can, you know, combine all of these different mediums to create a flow of information about their project. And I think as they realize how powerful any one of those streams can be, they realize that communication is about a lot more than writing a paper. And I would never say that writing a paper isn't a great skill. I've written a lot of papers and I feel like, you know, that has served me well, but I've also at this point written over 100 podcast scripts and very many videos and hundreds of Instagram captions. And I think I've probably reached a lot more people with those mediums than with my papers, right? I mean, no one has ever seen any of my papers except for my professors. And, you know, I learned to write that way. But now I sit down every Friday and write an email to 45,000 people. And it's my email that has the most impact in the world and not those papers. And so I just think it's like really important as teachers that we assign these new forms of communication the respect they deserve, because like it or not, I mean, a lot of minds are changed on Instagram. a lot of podcasts are changing the way we do things. Like, these are not irrelevant little, you know, social media channels.
So I have a question. It just popped into my head thinking about the 21st century composition, reaching these mass audiences. It really struck me with no one's going to read my paper, because I have a textbook right now. I'm working on an EDD, and in it, it says, no one will read your dissertation. And so it's like, oh, yes. But they're like, just so you know.
And shot through the heart.
You do all this, but besides your committee, your mom might skim through it, but no one's going to read it.
So harsh.
But you're so right that when it's in these more accessible pieces, that people will listen. And so I'm curious, what is it, your thought process when you're creating a blog or a podcast or Instagram, what components do you consider in terms of your word choice, image, filters? Like, what are those kind of creative thoughts that you're putting in relation to the message that you're trying to send or what you're wanting to communicate with that specific post?
Yeah, it's been a really interesting transition for me going from the type of writing that I used to do, going through my BA and MA, both in English, and then moving into the blogging world, which is far more conversational. Mm-hmm. And so it's really about just like talking to your friends and explaining what you'd like them to know in as clear and practical terms as possible. And so I want to tell interesting stories, and I want to create beautiful graphics that are memorable and easy to follow. And then I want to have a really clear, easy to implement process for doing whatever I'm trying to teach. And so it's not about like, you know, here are, you know, 5 pages of background and here is all of my buildup, everything that I've been doing this week to prepare for this blog post. No, like you don't, that's the point of this blog post, is for you mm-hmm. to skip that. And, mm-hmm. and here are the 3 main points that I want you to know about how to put this into practice. And here is a free template for doing it. Do it, you know, go do it today and then tell me about it on Instagram. And so, you know, that has been really an interesting journey for me. I think for me, it started with the strategy of one pagers. That was the first thing that I really fell in love with in the ed world, as like this blending of the verbal and the visual. And it was happening already. I learned about it, you know, in multiple places, but it just didn't have the overwhelming popularity. And I was like, this should have overwhelming popularity. This is unbelievable. Like, and everyone was like, oh, some of my kids hate art. They're never, this isn't going to work. And so I was like, how can we get past that art mm-hmm. thing? And so I designed these sort of templates where, like, even if you hate art, you can put this exact thing in this exact corner of the one pager and it will work. And so I put that out with like a really clear process in a post and a really kind of extensive free template. And, you know, at this point, I've probably given away 30,000 of those templates, and I hear all the time from people who are using it. And it's just like hexagonal thinking. I hear people say, wow, this is actually really working. This is cool. And I'm like, oh, I'm so happy.
That's awesome.
Could you talk a little bit about your maybe personal identity as a creative? Because I know some of the conversations I've had with other folks who are trying to advance multimodal composition and new forms of creating in the classroom say that one of the biggest struggles is teachers don't see themselves as designers. Teachers don't see themselves sometimes even as writers, especially as, you know, people who know how to design an Instagram or people who know how to blog. And part of that, I have to wonder, is if as teachers get more comfortable with those modes of composition, they're more comfortable scaffolding for their students, explaining for their students, because it really sounds like what you did is find a template, a tool that provides that scaffolding that teachers aren't maybe always able to produce themselves because they are English teachers. And that is a very limiting category for, I think, many people. So could you talk a little bit about your own, like, maybe journey to, like, how did you sort of emerge into or fuse your creative identity with your English teacher identity, as it were?
Yeah, interesting. I mean, as a student, what lit me up were the creative projects. And so that was part of my core identity as an English teacher from the start. I remember doing the mock trial of Flaubert and being Flaubert's defense attorney in my AP literature class. And just like, I read the whole original trial manuscript and wrote like a 12-page opening statement. And I was just like so into it. You know, and I remember putting on A Midsummer Night's Dream in college with my Shakespeare class and like painting the wall on the quad with our set. And just like, these were the things that mattered to me as a student. They're what I remember about my learning experiences. And so when I came into the classroom, those were the kinds of events I wanted to create. And I wasn't that interested in doing other things. Like, I really wanted all of my units to revolve around memorable learning experiences that would matter to my students. And so it was always like, what's the big thing going to be while we're studying poetry? Like, what's the big thing going to be while we're, you know, doing this? And if it was a novel, then maybe the big thing was a really interesting discussion method that helped us learn about group dynamics and sort of made us different in the way we spoke together and harmonized. Or if it was a play, maybe we're going to bring in a guest theater artist who was going to teach us, you know, how to do human sculptures and talk about that or whatever. And so that in those first years, as I designed all those projects, I just learned so much about how to create that type of experience in the classroom. And my students liked it. You know, I felt like it was really working for us. And I wanted to share that out more with the world. And so for me as a teacher, like, that was my natural inclination. And when I eventually left the classroom, it was really a joy for me to try to make those types of experiences accessible to all teachers by designing curriculum, by creating videos to explain it, by finding the tools like the ed tools that would make it really easy, or the tech tools. Like, I think it's very intimidating to start a podcast unit if you're unfamiliar with GarageBand or Audacity. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I found Vocaroo, which is an online recording tool where you literally just like press a red button or a green button when you want to start talking, and then you talk, and then you press a red button and it gives you an MP4. And so that's what students use. And that's all you need to record a podcast when you're 15, right? I mean, you just need to learn to create a script and record something. And then with 45 minutes on YouTube, if you're like, actually, I want to be a podcaster, you can learn about GarageBand, and that's enough. But that takes the overwhelm out of it for teachers. And I think that there are so many things like that. If you want to design beautiful curriculum, you know, Canva's your tool. Canva can do so much for you with templates and with beautiful backgrounds and interesting icons and stuff that will give your projects the look that you want. And you don't need to use Photoshop. I mean, I don't know much about any of those design tools, to be honest. I use Canva and I use Google Slides for everything. But it's a matter of like teaching somebody how to use Canva, right? Because if you don't know it, then you can't do an infographic project on Canva. You can't do a podcast cover with your students on Canva because you've never heard of Canva. And I had never heard of Canva until I started using it for my podcast cover and my Instagram designs, right? And so I have, because I'm sort of straddling those two worlds now between teaching and communicating with an audience through social media, I have the benefit of bringing one to the other.
That's awesome. And so I'm straying a little bit, but I'll connect it back to your three concepts. So when we first ask everyone to think of their concepts, we encourage you to make a list and narrow it down. And I noticed on your list was empathy. And the reason that it started out to me is because as you're talking and as you're sharing these different ideas, I can't help but notice how you're empathetic to the teachers and what they're trying to accomplish in the classroom, but maybe they don't have the tools, wanting to make the templates, make things as accessible and usable for them, empathy for the student experience and wanting them to enjoy what they're doing. And so my question, bringing us back to the concepts that you had chosen with the visual and verbal, the intersection there, even 21st century composition and this idea of empathy. How am I going through these different modes of communication and empathy interact or help students be able to empathize? I'm just curious what your thoughts are with that.
That's so interesting. I feel like empathy is at the core of so much in communication and in learning and in building relationships. And, you know, I was raised in an atmosphere where empathy was like at the heart of everything. My mom was a chaplain and a grief therapist. And like from when I was, you know, five, she was always talking about, well, there aren't really any bad guys, Betsy. Don't play like that you're against bad guys. They've probably had difficult circumstances and like da 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 has led them to this. And they, you know, and so I was always thinking about, you know, where do people's motivations come from? Like, why do they feel the way they feel? And I think in our education system, I was just talking about this with my husband, like not very much focus is put on the teacher well-being or the teacher creativity or the teacher communication with colleagues or empathy for the teacher. It's like the students do this. We've got the new thing from the district and you need to do this. And we don't really care how you feel about it. And we don't, you know, also, you need to collaborate, but we're not going to give you time to, but we're going to be mad at you if you don't. And like, I don't know. There are just so many directives that are about the system. And obviously, it's a hugely complicated system that spans so many people and so much money and whatever. But for me, like, it's about how can I help a teacher feel joyful in their teaching? How can I help them connect with their students? I think very much at the heart of studying literature and communicating with people is expanding your mind to other people's perspectives, thinking about what matters to them. It's very hard to communicate with somebody, teacher to student or student to audience in the world, if you don't understand where they're coming from, what matters to them. And you know, same for me, if I couldn't think about how my teachers were feeling and what problems they're facing, I couldn't be very effective as a coach for them. And as somebody who was creating materials for them, everything wouldn't land. Right. I mean,
absolutely
disaster.
That's such an important point. How much the humanity and empathy is oftentimes stripped out of the way that even just like the discourse around education is. And I'm sure that there are a lot of teachers that feel like they are these delivery vehicles for initiatives and technical policy documents that are put into a binder and plopped on their desk. And I love the way that you talk about, you know, teaching as a creative endeavor, that, you know, it's an opportunity for us to be creative, to be designers, and not even necessarily, you know, in a traditional sense. Like, I cannot draw. My artistic ability is incredibly, incredibly limited. But for me, education is such a it's always given me, I feel like, a context to be creative, to be a designer. And I found other modes of communication that I feel like I can bring to the table. So how do you find that teachers are reacting to this reframing of teaching as a more creative, which is creativity is one of your the central concepts, I think. How are they responding to that? And how is that making lights come on or maybe reigniting their passion for what they do?
I find that I hear a lot from people about trying out new strategies and just being really happy with how well they work. You know, that they're like, oh, I read about this thing and I decided to try it. We did digital blackout poetry, or we did an I Am From poem, or we did Genius Hour, or we did a podcasting unit, and it went so well, actually. Like, the students really engaged with it. It was cool. I'm interested in doing more of this. And that's lovely for me on a daily basis to be always getting this glow of positive feedback, and it inspires me to continue with the work. Partly it's probably that I'm attracting like-minded people to myself. Nobody is probably going to come and interact with me if they hate creative projects. But in general, I feel like people try something, they realize that it's working really well for them, they become interested, they try another one. And gradually they start to shift their instructional model from like a teacher delivering content to more of a project-based, creativity-focused curriculum. And then they like it. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
No, that's great. You definitely did. And I think that while maybe everyone who is an educator doesn't identify as like a creative person per se, I do think that every educator wants students to share the passion that they have for the discipline. And I think especially us English language arts folks who maybe have seen Dead Poet Society one too many times or something, you know, there is some, we're a quirky bunch where we truly want students to love the stories that we love, to love being storytellers themselves the way that we love that too. And I wonder if maybe you're helping guide teachers back to that a little bit. And that's just a really sort of, I guess, beautiful sentiment.
Nice. Well, it's certainly joyful work for me. I feel on a daily basis just super lucky to be doing what I'm doing, because I get to create in the ways that I love and I get to share it. And I feel like, you know, a lot of the projects that I share and the curriculum threads that I push for, you know, as a teacher, you don't have to feel like it's a creative project if you don't want to define it that way. I mean, having students create a podcast is just working in a viable 21st century medium, and an important one. And same thing really with blogging, same thing with any 21st century communication medium. These things are very relevant to the modern workplace. And so I think while it does feel like a creative spin on ELA, it's also a very practical one.
Yeah, you know, now I'm almost kind of wondering if there's this notion that the means that students are going to connect with the discipline is going to look different based on the sort of like informational internet ecology that they're growing up in. Like, mm-hmm. they might fall in love with, you know, a text that we grew up loving through blogging about it instead of writing a paper or having a conversation or through podcasting about it. And it really is, it's reminding me of Henry Jenkins' Reading in a Participatory Culture, which is a text that I read recently. Are you familiar? I see you nodding your head. Okay. And it's really all about how we can get students to really connect with deep, complex, disciplinary ideas by having them engage in it in a way that's familiar to them. They are, you know, students aren't just passively consume. Well, they might consume a lot of Netflix, but then they're going online and they're tweeting about it, they're Instagramming about it. And they really are a much more participatory generation than previously because they have the tools to do that. So could you maybe talk about how maybe like what that intersection is between these 21st century modes of composition and just like kids these days, as it were, are just used to being engaged and in more participatory, more multimodal kind of communication?
Yeah. Well, it kind of goes back to what I was talking about before with how visual the modern generation is. And I think because they have grown up with Snapchat, with Instagram stories, with Twitter, they're used to communicating like that. That seems normal to them, you know, creating a book snap about a book that they really like, where they snap a photo of it and tell a little bit of the plot and give it a hashtag and, you know, add little icons and whatever. Like, that's a fun little reading check-in for them that feels very familiar. Tweeting for a character, creating a blog from the perspective of a main character, or searching out social issues in a text that they're reading and then creating like a proposal for a social media campaign around, you know, a key concept from a novel. This is all normal. It's normal for them. It's part of their generation. And so I think building that into curriculum only helps us connect with students more. And again, it's just so relevant. It's not just like an arts and crafts project in English class where we're like, you know, coloring an Instagram post worksheet. It's like, this is how kids create meaning in the world. And I don't think that's going to change when they graduate from high school. And so teaching them how to do it well, teaching them that social media can be about real purpose and real learning and communication, giving them the tools to become, you know, the public face of their small business or the coffee shop they work at in college, and then, you know, the law firm that they start or whatever. Like, these things are very relevant. And I think if we introduce them as core parts of communication that we respect and that we think are important and we teach them, then there won't be this big divide between like English class and history class and anywhere where you're writing for school and like actually talking to people.
What advice do you have for educators who are maybe experiencing pushback, whether that's from fellow teachers, whether that's from potentially administrators, that, you know, somebody walks to their classroom and what they see doesn't look like what they traditionally see in a classroom. So they automatically assume, oh, this is just arts and crafts. And where's the intellectual rigor here? And we actually talked about with on our podcast with Angela Stockman, this notion that there are some certain aesthetic norms when it comes to classroom, like conversation and work production, that when, you know, somebody sees something that looks playful, that looks aesthetically well-designed, there is this very strange feeling of, oh, well, it can't be intellectually challenging then. And that's just like this weird disconnect. So how would you advise teachers push back against that, or maybe even better, invite people to see how what they're doing, again, as you were saying, it's not just arts and crafts, it's really authentic forms of knowledge production that any, you know, 21st century human being is going to use at some point in their lives.
Yeah, no, it's so interesting because I've had so much of this pushback myself. And so I can really relate to how teachers would feel about this. And what I have done, you know, when I was in the classroom and now what I recommend is that you really kind of do your own PR. And that's what I think of it as. It's like your public relations for your classroom. And not many people do this. I think it's not really recommended much to people. And so it's not necessarily natural, but it's easy and fun once you start thinking about it. Like, if your students are about to perform Death of a Salesman on the quad with like props that they've made and sets that they've designed, go ahead and invite the parents. Go ahead and invite your department chair and your dean of curriculum or whatever, and bring them on down to watch. If they're about to do a poetry slam, have some guest judges, invite somebody from the school board, invite your librarian, invite the head of the math department. Like, when you bring the outside in and you start to create sort of a liquid border to your classroom, then you get to showcase what's happening that's really beautiful there. And I found that that is really helpful because it defines what you're doing in terms of the final beautiful product. And if people haven't had a chance yet to understand the process along the way, they will probably understand the final product, that it's this really special moment for students, that they are showcasing work that they've that they care about passionately, that they've worked really hard on, that is actually a beautiful expression of their learning. And I haven't had that not go well.
I love that. I was trying to scribble it. So I take notes and I do typically like scribbled lists, but I liquid border to your classroom to showcase what's beautiful. Like that.
I love that too.
It's amazing. I'm going to type that up into some sort of pretty Canva template and I'll tweet it. Because that's, but it's, you know, like it's no matter, I know we're talking about ELA and like the English classroom, but it's really, that's kind of what we want in all of our classes. You know, it doesn't matter the discipline or the course. It's how can we help students see that these walls are not putting us in silos or breaking what's here from what's real out there, that idea of a liquid border and the relevance that you mentioned. So students, even in math class, they can do these things where they can understand the math. They can see the beauty of the math. They can also see it as working towards a relevant piece, whether it's a cause, it's communicating in some way, like beyond just getting an answer. How can our understanding help us solve or like address some of these different issues that we might learn about in other courses? So that's, I love that. The liquid border to your classroom. That's beautiful.
Have you had educators from other disciplines kind of like be like, hey, how can this look in history or in science or in math in Kayla's instance?
Yes. A lot. Yes. And I think, I mean, so much of it does translate beautifully. You could create a podcast in any discipline. You could create a one pager about any information, an infographic. You can certainly do hexagonal thinking in any field. And yes, I think, you know, that's true for most forms of communication, right? Because in every discipline across fields, mm-hmm. 21st century communication is happening. Mm-hmm. And so you can go in and find examples no matter your discipline, or you can be the person who creates them and sort of pioneers the way for others.
I know that one of my colleagues this year had her students in her history class create a wiki around events surrounding the Revolutionary War. And I have never seen kids so into a project before. It was amazing because, as you were saying, it's this more modern form of communication, but in presenting the information on this wiki, they were having the types of conversations that historians would have. Which person is the most relevant to this event? What interpretation of this event do we think is worth framing? And the kids would literally, I would walk into her class and, you know, the kids are furiously typing and debating on this Google thread, you know, next to their wiki. And it really is beautiful to see how when students are communicating in these modern mediums, how it really makes the content come alive too. And it's not this thing of like, let's get rid of, you know, disciplinary knowledge and skills and replace it with tech, but it's how can we use this technology to present information, to communicate, to create in ways that are authentic and meaningful. And I find that many times my students become more interested in the content because they have that entry point. So could you maybe talk about, have you had any teachers share that, you know, maybe students were really bored or even like antagonistic towards like what they were doing in the class, and after making the switch, it turned or transformed their classroom around?
Yeah, I'm just trying to find this term. I had interviewed Sarah Fine on her book In Search of Deeper Learning last year, and there was this this concept that had to do with, okay, I'm not going to find it right now, but there was this concept that had to do with baseball for learning. When you first learn baseball and you're in the little league, whatever, you don't just swing at the ball, practice your swing 1,000 times, right? And then practice catching a ball 1,000 times. You like have a couple practices when you're six, and then you play a game, even though you're going to be bad, yeah. Right? And you're going to like miss every pitch. You're still going to maybe get to run one time to first base. Maybe you're going to get a grounder to you. And so, your learning of baseball is going to mean something to you because you know you have a game this weekend. And I think in the classroom, it's the same. And this argument has already been made by this Harvard researcher that Sarah was quoting to me. But this was one of the learning concepts in her book that I found the most relevant and interesting and aligned with what I do. Because if students are always just practicing a skill, a communication skill, if they're practicing writing a thesis over and over, if they're practicing creating their quotation sandwich over and over, like, it's just not very interesting for them. But if, as you say, you know, they're learning how to identify the most important figure in a historical event and then communicating that to other people who will care, you know, and who are out there reading their writing, that's huge. And it changes everything. And I think there are so many things in the classroom, starting from kindergarten, that you can make this shift on, where it's not just skill practice forever until you graduate from college. It's like skill practice followed quite closely by doing something with it. If you're studying, you know, social justice themes in a book, like, how could you translate that into changing something in your community or making a difference? If you're studying, you know, the latest YA in your choice reading library and your school board thinks that YA is a waste of time and that nobody should have it in their curriculum, like, as a student, how might you raise your voice? How might you talk to the school board about that? How might you create a video explaining your opinions and put it on YouTube? And then how can you get the message out there that that YouTube video is there? Like, those ways of creating a thesis and then exploring your thesis can feel really powerful to kids in a way that just exploring it on paper with no audience can feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds so beautifully aligned with, I guess, our vision of disciplinary literacy. Having students be practitioners, even if they are like baby practitioners who will be making mistakes, like a little, you know, kid trying to hit the tee ball off the tee. It's that opportunity to feel like they're doing something relevant, authentic, and embedded in the world around them, and not this dry, decontextualized, you know, hitting the ball 1,000 times sort of drill work. So I love that. There's actually, when I was doing some research on disciplinary literacy, there was a really interesting study that talked about having teachers meet with actual science teachers meeting with scientists to talk about, like, what does it mean to be a scientist? How do you view the field? How are you engaging in research? And then them as teachers talking about that process, and then thinking about how can we design learning experiences for our students that will give them an opportunity to do that. And like the group that had the most highest effect size in terms of students learning, the group that took the most away in a very meaningful fashion from the research was the one who had all three of those sort of groups working and talking and collaborating, which is just exciting for me to think about. How can we make those liquid borders in our classroom and bring real people, real workers or disciplinarians into our classroom to share? So love that. So if people are interested in learning more about how to have their students engage in creative, authentic, 21st century communication and creativity, I got almost all three of the concepts, in fact, in part, where would you recommend that they go?
Well, I'd probably send them to my website. It's www.nowsparkcreativity.com. And from there, they could find my podcast, my blog posts, my Instagram, all the good things.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. We sincerely enjoyed having you.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Conceptually Speaking. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and are coming away with a stronger grasp of the concepts and mental models that help us understand our world. If you like this podcast, feel free to like, comment, or subscribe on your favorite platform. If you want to learn more or get involved, check out our website at edtosavetheworld.com and join our Facebook group, Learning That Transfers.